Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Hello, Ilona Thompson from Palate Exposure, where we talk to people who practice passion. I'm coming to you today from beautiful, sunny Paso Robles. And I'm here with Daniel Dow of Dow Vineyards. I've been looking forward to this interview for a while. Daniel is a true visionary, and he practices what he preaches in a variety of ways. I'm very privileged to get to know him today and to let you guys in on the conversation. So, there's so many stories to uncover. So, I like to think of it as past, present, and future. So We'll dive into the past first. You had a very unusual childhood. You grew up in Lebanon.
I did.
Tell us about that.
I grew up in Lebanon until the age of nine. Lebanon was known as the Paris of the Middle East. It was very Western. Mm-hmm. Beautiful beaches, beautiful coastlines, beautiful food. Most people know about Lebanese food. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a beautiful childhood, and that pretty much came to a halt in 1973. I was 8 years old.
Yeah.
And the Civil War had just begun, and the first rocket that actually exploded in the Civil War came to our house. So my family, we almost all died, and you know, I was shot. I have a shrapnel in my heart still today. I was shot in the face. My brother was in the coma for 48 hours. My sister, who now passed away, lost all motion in her fingers and her shoulder, also received a lot of shrapnel. And you have to understand that we didn't know what war is. It would be like me telling you, Ilona, you know, you're out in Carmel enjoying a nice sunny day and suddenly a bomb explodes. It's like we had no idea where that came from. My mom, having been raised and born, she was born on a French island, but raised in France and on a French mm-hmm. island, had the French citizenship. So. When the war then stopped in 73 and started again in 75, and that's when my dad said, okay, enough, we're leaving. So, immigrated to France, where I pretty much, most of my youth was spent in France. Lived in Paris, and also in Cannes, south of France. And Cannes was amazing. It really brought back the Mediterranean, you know, joie de vivre that we grew up with in Lebanon. You know, orchards, vineyards, beautiful weather, the beach, great food, and those really were the things that we reminisced a lot, having missed them when we left Lebanon. So it kind of always holds a special place in my heart, south of France, where we lived for several years. Of course, Paris is beautiful. Paris was a little more of a shock for us. Still love Paris. You know, I go back every year at least once or twice. And then when I turned 18, my brother had already come to the United States to, he wanted to study engineering. I followed him. And, you know, we knew that there was not much of a future in France. Frankly, opportunities in France and in Europe in general for young people often, you know, are lacking. America does a great job giving you a chance to be somebody and have a dream and fulfill it. And immigrated here, we were totally out of money. I was $20 in my pocket, ate pasta for a couple months because I thought I could survive for a long time with pasta. I had some protein, some carbs, and I had a lot of olive oil at home, so that did the job. But I was able to get a job, and so did my brother, and paid our school, worked 40 to 60 hours while taking 4 to 5 classes at GCSD, and both ended up graduating with an engineering degree. He got an electrical engineering, I got a computer engineering degree, and my parents immigrated at the time, and I was young, I was 21 years old, my brother was 25, and we knew we had to, it was do or die. It was like, you know, we had to do something, or our parents could never live here. And you know, we had jobs, we had job offers. I was offered to, at 21, to run the compact disc interactive for Philips and Sony. But I had started a business on the side, doing computer networking. And I was getting so many phone calls, so I saw the opportunity. So I approached my dad first and said, you're down to your last 50 grand. Why don't you give it to me and you can fund my company? And he said, well, if your brother's in, I'm in. So George was accepted to get an MBA at Stanford. I convinced him to stay. And we all three of us went to Costco, bought a few tables, leased an office. Actually, we started in the garage, really, technically. And America's great. It gave us a chance to be successful. I would walk into hospitals with my brother and would offer them a proposal for $1 million. And here were two kids, at the time probably 22 and 26. And we'd say the project's going to be $1 million and we need 70 or 80% down payment to actually get started. And the answer was, yeah, you guys can do it. Here's the money. Get it done. Shocking. I mean, this could have never happened anywhere else in the world.
Yes.
So I started, we started the company in 1987.
Mm-hmm.
And by 1997, 10 years later, our company went public. It was the fifth best IPO on Wall Street. And at a very young age, I was in my early 30s, 31 or 32, both my brother and I retired. My passion had always been wine. Growing up in France, especially in the south of France, my dad, you know, was always my greatest hero. My dad walked on water for all of us. He was just a kind man, smart, shrewd, but at the same time had class and, you know, tolerant, never pushed his opinion on others, very loving. My dad would walk into a room and he had so much ethos that literally people would stop and just like, who's this person? He had that kind of energy. So we grew up around an incredible father. So one thing he wasn't good at is he was terrible at honeydews. Like, I never saw my dad, you know, cook or, you know, take out the garbage. It's just not his thing. Doesn't mean it's right or wrong. It's just he wasn't good at that. Like, he could never make coffee. But I remember, like, my first vivid memory of wine. I was 13 years old in south of France, and I heard a lot of commotion. And I saw my dad carrying boxes. And I had never seen my dad carry boxes, move around the house. I'm like, okay, what's going on here? So I come in and I see him so excited. And he was carrying these boxes and stacking them up in a cool closet in the house. And he was like a kid, like a kid who just received a big gift. And I look at him, I go, what's going on? He said, wait till you see this wine. I just got a great deal on this 1975 bottle of Cheval Blanc. I was able to get a special deal and bought 5 cases. I can't wait for you to try it. And I had never really experienced wine before. I was, you know, 15 years old probably, or 14. So my dad would open up a bottle of this wine. I think he went through the 5 cases pretty quickly, and obviously would always collect wine and drink them. And he would open up a bottle and he would have a couple glasses at lunch, take a nap in the afternoon, typical Mediterranean life, you know. At night he would go back and finish the bottle. And I would sit with him and he would always give me a little wine to drink. And you know what mesmerized me was more than just the wine, because at 14, it's kind of hard to taste wine and go, oh, okay, I love wine. But it was seeing his reaction, you know, how this thing he was drinking, called wine, made him joyful, relaxed. You know, he would get very philosophical, talk about life. And I'm like, wow, you can actually drink this and become like that? And that to me was my first reaction that, wow, what an incredible thing. I mean, you can actually really become like such an incredible human being by actually drinking wine. So of course he would give me wine to drink. He always put a little water in it. And that was my first recollection of wine. And in my early 20s, especially when I got a job and I started making a little money, I loved wine. So I would go out and collect wine, drink wine. And I think every house I've ever owned, I've either lost a bathroom or a closet to build a wine cellar. And I wanted to be a winemaker. As crazy as it may sound, you know, here I am, I'm running a publicly traded company, but all day long, all I did is read about wine and winemaking, went through all the chemistry, and I would meet with investors all day, and at night I would read about winemaking, read about wines, taste wine, drink wine, and go to sleep. And I was obsessed, and it consumed me. I wanted to be a winemaker. And that's very important for you to understand is, you know, a lot of people don't understand why we got into this winery business. They think, you know, oh, these are two guys that made money, you know, and they just want to throw money around and start a winery. We never started this winery because we wanted to be, you know, have a trophy winery.
Yeah.
This was all driven because of passion. This was driven, at the end of the day, because I wanted to make wine, which is why I laugh when people often ask me, you know, after they meet me, they go, well, who's your winemaker? And my answer is, look at them saying, me. why in the world would I want to do this if I can't make wine? And you know, I want to make wine to the last day I live. That's how consumed I am by just enamored with the whole winemaking process and crafting wines. So we started the winery, and so for 8 years, I looked everywhere. Everything I studied pointed to the fact that terroir, 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 it's all about terroir. You can have the greatest restaurant in the world, but if you're on the Mojave Desert and nobody knows about you, well, it's not going to be very successful. And same with wine, it's about location, it's about where you are, it's about the climate, it's about the soil, of course, about winemaking techniques, etc. So after looking for 8 years and after searching, I knew I wanted to find the same soils as Bordeaux. I didn't want to be in Bordeaux for many reasons. First of all, it's too hierarchical, too limiting, everything has already been discovered. So thinking from a scientific standpoint, right, you got to look at the forest, not the trees. So I proceeded through elimination. And my thinking was, well, it wasn't like 1,000 years ago, there was a delegation that was appointed by many countries in the world, and they appointed them to go and circle the entire globe to find the best place to grow Cabernet Sauvignon, right? That didn't happen. It was the best place in France, and maybe Europe, okay? Why? Because it had great soils that could drain, because the soils had minerality. So I thought in my mind, as a pure scientist and an engineer, maybe there's a better place to grow Cabernet, right? I mean, after all, it's kind of like saying, we exist on this world, but mathematically speaking, there's probably life somewhere else in the world, right? In the universe is so big, mathematically speaking, purely from a statistical standpoint, right? There could be life on another planet. Well, for me, statistically speaking, there could have been another place that could actually grow great Cabernet Sauvignon and Cabernet Franc and Bordeaux varieties. So then my question is, well, where is this place? And that's what I spent 8 years looking for. And it came down to terroir. I knew a couple things. I knew that the soils that most vineyards in France and in Italy and in Germany are vines grow great on are calcareous clay soils. In French, we call that argilo-calcaire. These soils are known to give you natural acidity, not added. Why? Because they have low levels of potassium and they tend to bind to everything. So the pH doesn't go up even if you hang for a long time. So I wanted to create a purest expression of Cabernet Sauvignon. Okay. So these soils were very important to find, because without these soils, you know, I wasn't going to get the results I was looking for. I also knew that the climate in Napa was fantastic. Napa does a great job ripening Cabernet Sauvignon, which is why their phenolics are higher, which is why the flavors are amazing, right? So in my mind, I thought, what if I could find a place that had the soils of Bordeaux and the climate of Napa? I would strike gold. And it was a crazy dream, and I looked many places all over the world, and then one day I went on Google, and I thought, surely California should have some limestone soils. Maybe I can find a piece of limestone soils, calcareous clay, that actually maybe created my own AVA even, because I was just like, I don't know where to look for. I had no idea Paso Robles existed. So I went on Google and typed in limestone, California. And I had thousands of pages that had Paso Robles in them. And I thought, where is this? I thought it was in Mexico first. Like, you know, Paso Robles, Spanish. So I came up here and it was love at first sight. I fell in love with the area, and I fell in love especially with the Adelaida district, which is the district we're in. Very different terroir than the rest of Paso. Not to be bad-mouthing the rest of Paso, I think every sub-appellation excel at a certain variety. But the Adelaida district has more clay, so you need clay, not just limestone. And so you had these soils, which were argilo-calcaire or calcareous clay. And you know, the clay is gonna give you, so typically in our soils here, you will find the first 18 inches or so have actually clay. And the underneath it is the limestone subsoil. Now, the clay is very important. A lot of people want to, you know, downplay the clay part, but the clay part is very important. See, the clay part is going to give you bouquet, which is very important. It's going to give you fatness and flesh in the wine, which is why, again, Napa, you know, which is mostly clay and loam, has a lot of these fat in the wine, flesh, which is beautiful. But then underneath that 18 inches, you get the limestone subsoil or the calcareous, you know, soils. And that soil is going to allow us to make sure we make wine that are pure expression without adding acid. We basically add yeast and nutrients, and that's about it. And they're going to give you minerality, which, you know, as a European, which I grew up in Europe, I can't just drink wine that have like fruit and alcohol. It doesn't do it for me. I need complexity. I need layers. I need minerality. I need acidity. I'm used to that. So these soils give you that. Then the surprising fact that we have here is, given that we found this terroir, we're at 2,200 feet elevation. So we are, if you ask a pilot, you know, every 1,000 feet you drop about 5 degrees. Well, we're at 2,200 feet. We're the highest elevation vineyard in Paso. So we automatically, the highs are going to be much lower than the rest of Paso. So we see on the average about 5 days over 100 degrees here on our mountain. The rest of Paso, especially on the east side of Paso, can see 30 to 40. So quite a bit of a difference. So after doing all these studies, we found that the temperature here almost equals the one of San Elena in Napa. So I actually fulfilled my dream by finding a place that had the soils of Bordeaux and the climate of Napa, which are two great characteristics. And this is really the best way I can describe that mountain. We end up with wines that have the phenolics, that have the fat, that have the beautiful climate that is reflected in the wines. But at the same time, you get the minerality, you get the natural acidity. It doesn't bite in the back of the jaw, it doesn't scratch. And as I'm understanding my wines better, I'm finding out that in the first 5 years, you taste mostly the baby fat that comes from the climate. But then after about 5 years, these wines transcend to an entire other level. And then the minerality comes out, and the natural acidity comes out, and the layers and the complexity from the soil start really coming up in the glass. So it's a beautiful thing to see them evolve. So in a nutshell, that's the story. My brother and I decided to plant our flag here, moved here, and it was love at first sight, and we never looked back.
Now listening to you, you can hear the passion, you can hear the commitment, but you can also hear the practical side. I want to actually go back to that moment when you borrowed money from your dad. That had to have been a monumental step right there, given how you felt about him, given the context, given just the incredible level of commitment and responsibility he had to put on yourself first and foremost. What was that like to take? It took so much courage.
It took a lot of courage, and I won't lie, it was a lot of pressure for my brother and I. Our first priority was not to take care of ourselves. Our first priority is to care of our parents, because they were the most wonderful, giving, loving parents anybody could ever dream of. And for us to see them suffer in their, you know, later years, because they, unfortunately, because of the war, because of immigration, they lost everything they had. For us to see them struggle through that would have been an impossible thought. So we would have moved mountains to make sure we take care of our parents. And frankly, the priority was never to take care of ourselves. We knew we were fine. I mean, we had degrees in engineering. We had offers left and right for people to hire us. We could have gone and gotten a great job, worked for somewhere else. But what would we do with our parents? And that was the first priority.
Is it partly a cultural value that you practice, or
yes,
is it just highly personal, both?
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely a cultural value. You know, we honoring your parents is a huge deal in our culture, where I come from. Honoring the older sibling is very important. Like, for instance, when I first got married, I asked my brother, who's older than me, his permission, because, you know, it's very important. When I'm with my brother today, I will often not talk. I will let him talk, because that's the form of respect we have where we come from. We honor the elder, we honor our parents. So it meant a lot to us. We could never face ourselves in the mirror knowing that we neglected our parents, or, you know, my older siblings. It's a form of respect.
Just want to highlight that for a moment, because in American culture, at least, we value youth, it feels like. Age and the wisdom that's associated with it is often seen as passé. It's not highlighted, it's not honored, it's not elevated. And you come from a very different place internally.
I do, and you know, often people think I'm quiet, again. Yeah, and I'm not. the last thing I'm is quiet. But when I'm around my brother, they're like, oh, he's the quiet one. I'm like, no, I'm not the quiet one, but I'm not going to sit down and fight for air with my brother, who's older than me. So I will give him the respect. So one person that I know, who's one of my mentors, actually put it really well. He goes, when you're alone, you're the alpha. But when you're your brother, he becomes the alpha. I said, that's true. And I have no problem with it.
That is actually really unique, you know, to have this much emotional EQ or emotional bandwidth, to be able to embrace so fully where you came from and internalize it and really hold it dear at every step in your journey, because it permeates who you are.
It does, and I'm teaching my children the same. I mean, it's something that we pass on to the next generation.
So you clearly had the talent and the smarts, and you know, you were obviously both fantastic students based upon what you've shared as far as job offers and being, you know, notably very desirable in your field of work. So when you started your company, what was in your mind, like what would give you that competitive edge besides, you know, being obviously in the right place at the right time and having the right talent to address the need in the marketplace? But what, from the entrepreneurship standpoint, what gave you that push? What empowered you to do it?
Well, I mean, in terms of the wine business, right?
I was talking about the computer business.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was survival. I mean, we had no choice. We're in a foreign country, which we weren't American citizens back then.
Yeah.
Our parents are broke. We have 2 degrees. And in all our life, we've lived fighting. We had to fight for life when we were 8 years old and 10 years old. We had to fight for life when we immigrated to France, and it's a whole new environment. And, you know, I mean, all our life, we're used to fighting. So for us, this was another fight, and we were bred for it. So we had no, you know, a lot of people grow up and, you know, are sheltered. We weren't sheltered. We had no problem, my brother and I, walking into a hospital at 21 and 24 years old and saying, here's a proposal, we want to get this deal. We'll give you the best deal, and we'll deliver the best computer network system you'll ever have. We were bold enough to say that, and people liked that. People saw the confidence. And plus, we were engineers. They trusted engineers. At the time, a lot of people were not engineers competing in this market. They had never even gone to college. But they saw two educated engineers from a top school coming in and saying, and had the confidence and the boldness to say, we'll deliver it. And you know what? We did, every time, because it was our name on the company. It's called Dow Systems, and our family was behind it, and we could never disappoint our clients. We could never disappoint our family. So we worked 7 days a week. We never took a day off, and we were successful. But it was that survival mode, you know, growing up in a place, I mean, imagine for a second being 9 years old, right before we left. And I never forgot this. One night, my dad was traveling, and, you know, there was a village that was just totally massacred like 2 days before. And the area we lived in was more suburban, but we heard that they were gonna bomb and come and kill everybody. And here we are, we all slept in one room, hoping that basically we're not gonna be next. I mean, when you grow up with that kind of a feeling or that kind of an experience, it doesn't faze you to be challenged by, you know, starting a new company. You've accomplished a lot more than that in life. So we have no fear. What is there to lose? The worst thing we can do is go back to where we started. And you know what? It wasn't too bad. So we're fine.
The reason I wanted you guys to hear this is because they're perilous from that point to what happened in Paso Robles, a region that was relatively unknown. Now everyone has heard of Paso in some way, shape, or form, particularly in the wine world. But when you came here, you were a pioneer in many respects. And certainly your mentality is just what leadership is made of. And I wanted to learn more about the origins of that. And now it's become much more clear what facilitated that.
You're hitting on a very good point. You know, when we first came in to Paso, I'm sure we ruffled some feathers. You know, both George and I are extremely driven, extremely competitive, and we have no fear. And some people recognize it as a high tide floats all boats, and these are two very driven individuals who are going to take Paso to the next level. And many people did. Of course, many people did not. We heard it all. Oh, these guys are throwing money left and right. They don't know what they're doing. These people should go to Napa. What are they doing here in Paso planting Cabernet? These people have no clue how to grow vines. Why are they here? I mean, we heard it all. But you know, it's interesting. I just had a big tasting with, I'm not going to mention his name, but one of the most important critics. Okay. I meet with critics every year. They taste our wines. Mm-hmm. And during the conversation, after several glasses of wine, he looked at me and he said, you know, 2 years ago, I would hear all the time complaints about you. It was like, this guy's trying to change the region. This guy's doing this. He goes, but in the last 2 years, all I hear is good. Or, these guys have actually done it. They've elevated past to the next level. And you know what? It's working. So kudos to you, he said. And you know what? And that's really what we hope, because we're not here to hurt the community. We're not here, to hurt the region. And we realized that it doesn't take one great winery to lift the region. It takes many wineries. So our goal, like, this is why I started the PRCC, the Paso Robles Cab Collective, in 2012, because my goal was, you know, this wine region will never be known for ultra-premium Cabernet Sauvignon, and is the next frontier for premium Cabernet Sauvignon. If one or two wineries make great cabs, we need 20, 30 wineries making 100-point cabs if possible. So that's why I started the PRCC, because I wanted to share the knowledge. I wanted to, you know, team up with the community and pull our efforts together to really put Paso on the map. And you know, it's been successful. Today, most critics talk about Paso being a great premium region for high-end Cabernet Sauvignon. So it's slowly happening, but it is happening.
I don't want to say that you single-handedly elevated the region, but it does take that leadership, that one person to say, this is what I want to happen and execute on it. And again, it takes a lot of courage.
Absolutely. And again, I'm not trying to say I'm the only one who did it. I'm definitely saying that, you know, it was the initial push. But without the help of all these wineries in town that realized the opportunity that we have here, that we can compete with Bordeaux, that we can compete with Napa or Washington, because this region can handle premium Cabernet Sauvignon. Without their help, this would have never happened. I mean, I can tell you, and I don't mind speaking about it, but many wineries that were never focused on Cabernet, they were more focused on Rhone or Zin, in the last 2 years came to meet with me. And they literally, in their words, told me all about the same thing. They said, you know what you've shown us can be accomplished here with high-end Cabernet Sauvignon, open our eyes. So many of these wineries have purchased other lands in Paso, planting Cabernet Sauvignon. In the next 2-3 years, you will see it. There will be many high-end Cabernets, premium Cabernets, that are expensive, that will be released in Paso, and they will have high ratings and they will have great reviews because they still well can handle it. So in a way, that's really the success, that wineries believed enough that if one winery can do it, many others can.
This is such a powerful example for life, not just for the wine world. When I travel, I often use you as an example. You're my top case study in leadership.
Well, thank you, Nora.
No, I mean, I've been watching the evolution in awe. And we'll get back to it in a moment, but I want to pause also on the piece when you retired. And think about you guys. You had all the choices in the world. You could have had the Vanity brand anywhere in the world. You're 32 years old. The world is your oyster in many respects. And yet you decided to roll up your sleeves and come to a relatively unknown region and build a business from scratch.
Yep.
And I know winemaking is a huge piece of it, but were there other, in terroirs you described so eloquently, but were there other reasons why you decided to take on an enormous project?
You know, it was faith. It was... We really believed it was our destiny. We came here, we saw the place, we saw the region, and we believed. We believed from day one that, based on everything I had studied for 8 years, that this had the potential. Now, there were a couple of wineries that opened up my eyes. There was one winery in particular that made wines that really opened up my eyes in terms of the quality that can be accomplished here, and it was Le Montieu, started by Stéphane Asseyo. I have to say that if he was not around, I may have been more scared. But when I tasted his wines, I felt that, well, okay, this guy is reaching the potential I think we can reach. So I'm going to move here and make it happen. I chose the Adelaide district because I felt that it would be better for Cabernet, for Cabernet Franc and for the Bordeaux varieties. It's above the fog line, so you get the sun that you need. You get the great soils that have more clay, which is very important for Cab. So... But I have to tell you, many times I thought I was crazy. I mean, I was 40 years old when I actually decided to become a winemaker, change my career. And let me just be very transparent. Everything I had worked hard to make the previous 20 years, I bet on this.
Wow.
So not too many people are winning. I could have just retired and enjoyed playing golf every day and traveling. You know, I had the money to do it, but I bet it all here. And it was not an easy thing. The first few years, I have to say that many times I'd wake up thinking, I'm either crazy or I'm onto something really good. And I think the first time I knew I was onto something really good and I got confirmed is when the first wines from the estate were reviewed by Jeb Dunnick, who at the time was with the Wine Advocate. He gave the Soul of a Line a 96 points. At the time, no Cabernet ever from Paso had received more than 95 points in basically in Paso Robles. And the one that received 95, I think it was once over many years. So when I received that rating, I'm like, I'm not crazy. Somebody else thinks that this is a great region for Cab.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.